But now for the reason we're here, Judge London. His career and character building experiences span from being a gardener to a taxi driver to his current role as Superior Court Judge here in Orange County. He attended high school locally and is a graduate from Garden Grove High School. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree with high honors in English from Cal State Fullerton and is Juris Doctor cum laude from Brigham Young University. Judge London and his wife live in Lake Forest and are the parents of six children, all adults at this point. In his spare time, Judge London enjoys bicycling, kayaking, hiking, and spending time with his family. And we'll turn the time over to Judge London now. Thank you.
Of all the founding fathers, James Madison is most recognized as the one with no personality. He's called the most boring founding father. He was called the man without a personality. He was small, sickly, and shy. He was awkward in social settings. He avoided gossip and small talk, and he always felt more comfortable around books than around people. Despite his complete lack of charisma, James Madison's contribution to this country is beyond measure. He's the father of the Constitution. He's the father of the Declaration of father of the Bill of Rights. These are our two most important governing documents. He's responsible for the nation's capital moving to Washington, D.C. He was a longtime special advisor to President Washington. He was a brilliant Secretary of State to Thomas Jefferson, and he helped facilitate the Louisiana Purchase. He became our fourth president. He strategically guided the country through the War of 1812, the Second War of Independence, and he ushered in an unprecedented decade of confidence and prosperity called the feel-good years. And then he gathered together over 12,000 pages of notes, correspondence, and documents about the founding of the country, and those are the priceless James Madison papers housed in the Library of Congress. Some historians believe that James Madison was our most important and most influential founding father. But he has no monuments or memorials on the National Mall. He's not on Mount Rushmore. He's not even on our money. And so some people consider him the least appreciated and least known of our founding fathers. I call him the Rodney Dangerfield of the founding fathers. He gets no respect. It wasn't until 1918 that the Treasury Department finally recognized him and put him on the $5,000 bill. But two decades later, they stopped printing the Madison bill. And a decade after that, they illegally removed it from circulation. It wasn't until 1976 that Congress finally recognized James Madison by naming the third building of the Library of Congress after him. But being shy, antisocial, and boring, it's almost a miracle that Madison accomplished as much as he did, but he had three things working for him. Number one, more important than his brilliance was his work ethic. He wasn't a born genius like Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, but he studied harder and prepared more thoroughly than anyone else. And he became recognized by his peers as the leading authority on constitutional law, political philosophy, and politics. Number two to his success, he was best friends of Thomas Jefferson. Number three, his wife was Dolly Madison. So I'm going to focus briefly on 16 areas of James Madison life and legacy. I'm going to give you an actual countdown so you don't have to worry about when we're going to finish. So number one, his childhood and youth. He was James Madison Jr., was born in 1751. He was the oldest of 12 children. His father inherited a 5,000-acre tobacco plantation with its slaves, and his father became the largest landowner and leading citizen in Orange County, Virginia. In the 1760s, the family moved into their new mansion, Mount Pilier, which is on a gentle rise overlooking the Blue Ridge Mountains. As a child, James Madison was homeschooled because of his fragile health and his mom was a hypochondriac. From age 11 to 16, he was sent away to boarding school where he studied history, political philosophy, and classical and modern languages. But concerned about his health, his mother brought him home from school at the age of 16, and for the next 2 years he was tutored by prominent tutors in Virginia. He decided to go to college, during this time, his concern about the health, Madison grew to a whopping 5'4" tall, and he never reached 100 pounds. He was definitely our smallest president, and when you have your best friend as Thomas Jefferson, who's well over 6 feet, kind of looks like Mutt and Jeff with those two together. He did not attend college in the College of William and Mary nearby, like all of his associates, because his mom was worried about the climate in colonial Williamsburg, so he attended the brand new College of New Jersey, which became Princeton. He went through the 4 years of study in 2 years, often sleeping only 4 hours a night and jeopardizing his health so he could study law, politics, political philosophy, and ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, and he became Princeton's first graduate. Then he stayed an extra year at Princeton to be tutored by the university president, John Witherspoon, famous founder, who was an advocate of natural law. Well, like a lot of college graduates in 1772, he returned home having no clue what he was going to do. Number two, his military service and early political career. In the early 1770s, he keeps saying 1970s, in the early 1770s, the conflict between the Brits and the Americans heated up. In 1774, Madison was selected to sit on the Committee of Safety. So throughout the country, those were the committees that oversaw the revolution responses, and the Sons of Liberty kind of morphed into the Committee of Safety. So in 1774, he was appointed to the local Committee of Safety. In 1775, with no military training or experience at all, he was commissioned as a full colonel in the county militia. It might be explained how he became a colonel because he was appointed as second in command to his father. Of short stature and fragile health, Madison knew he would never see battle, and so he decided to go into politics, where he excelled. He was first elected as a delegate to the Virginia Convention, which produced Virginia's first constitution. There, Madison advocated and supported Thomas Jefferson's statute for religious liberty, which failed, and at that time, Madison and Jefferson became lifelong friends and lifelong allies. Madison had personally witnessed the persecution of Baptist preachers who were beaten and arrested because they were preaching without a license from the Church of England. And so he and Thomas Jefferson became lifelong advocates of religious liberty. In 1779, Madison was elected to the Virginia Governor's Council to advise the governor, Thomas Jefferson. Also in 1779, he was elected to the National Congress of the Confederation, so pre-government Congress, where he established himself as a master of politics, became an expert at finding common ground and working out compromises. So you'll see in the handout a few pages on some of the compromises he worked out. Now, during these years, Madison spent hundreds, if not thousands, of hours in an intense study of political philosophy, politics, and government. So after serving in the Congressional Confederation Congress for 4 years, he won election to the Virginia House of Delegates. And in 1784, a bill was introduced into the Virginia House to tax the taxpayers to pay for the clergy. This bill was strongly supported by Patrick Henry, the dynamic orator of give me liberty or give me death. Madison and Jefferson, although not churchgoers, were vehemently opposed to this bill and vehemently opposed to what Patrick Henry was trying to do. And so Jefferson tried to reintroduce his bill to protect religious freedom. And so Madison, in response, wrote his one of his most famous essays, which he gave the boring title to, of Memorial and Remonstrance. That has become a leading document in the separation of church and state issues, and every major Supreme Court decision cites Madison's essay. Madison first defined religion as the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it. Then he gave a lengthy list, a checklist, supporting religious liberty. Some of these included, one, religion is a matter of personal conscience, not government dictate. Number two, religious liberty is an inalienable right from our Creator, and for government to interfere is an offense against God. Number three, civil magistrates are not competent judges of religious truth. Number four, government interference with religious freedom hinders the means of salvation. And number five, history has proven that when government and religion are intertwined, both are corrupted. So Madison convinced the legislature to reject Patrick Henry's bill and convinced them to enact Jefferson's statute for religious freedom. Jefferson considered that statute one of his three greatest accomplishments, and it's on his gravestone along with the Declaration of Independence and founding the University of Virginia. Well, so the flamboyant Patrick Henry was defeated by the little shy Madison, and Patrick Henry took the defeat personally. He became a lifelong enemy of Madison, and they referred to him as the anti-Madison. No matter what Madison proposed, Patrick Henry opposed, including the U.S. Constitution. Number three, the father of the Constitution. In the 1780s, it became clear to Madison that the Articles of Confederation, which were governing the colonies, were not working. And he was convinced that you could not tweak those, they had to be replaced. So he started preparing. As the delegates prepared for the famous Philadelphia Convention, the 36-year-old Madison drafted a proposed constitution that became known as the Virginia Plan. Most of the delegates came ready to debate and discuss the Articles of Confederation, and were very surprised that Madison was trying to produce a new constitution entirely. But Madison had done his homework and had already convinced influential George Washington and Ben Franklin that that was the way to go. And so because of Madison's efforts, the Philadelphia Convention became the Constitutional Convention. Now, during the Constitutional Convention, the shy and studious Madison was forced to speak over 200 times in debating issues on the Constitution. He was not a public speaker. He was not dynamic. In fact, some of the delegates recorded in their journals that they couldn't even hear him. But one of the delegates wrote that every delegate seemed to acknowledge Madison's greatness in the management of every great question. He took the lead. He always comes forward as the best informed man on any point. So his political success was his mastery of finding common ground and working out compromises. In fact, some people refer to Madison as the great compromiser, and you'll see a list of some of his great compromises in the handouts. Now, the most difficult question for the delegates was not how to design a federal government, but whether sovereignty should remain in the states or whether sovereignty should go to the federal government. So there again, Madison worked out a compromise of shared sovereignty between the federal government and the states, with check and balances against each other. During the debates, Madison was able to outmaneuver the stubborn ideologues through cooperation, compromise, and reason. Throughout his life, Madison repeatedly demonstrated that cooperation in government is better than confrontation. Compromise is more productive than ideological purity, and reason will ultimately prevail over emotion. Number four, the ratification debate and the Federalist parties. So in 1787, they adopted the Constitution, but it was sent out to the states for ratification. Ratification was not guaranteed. So Alexander Hamilton came to Madison and John Jay to convince them to write a series of newspaper articles explaining and defending the proposed Constitution. So they wrote 85 essays. Madison wrote 26. These were published. And then later they were published in a book form of the Federalist Papers, and those became the handbook for supporters of the Constitution. Well, the ratification vote in Virginia was crucial, but the popular Patrick Henry, the anti-Madison, opposed the Constitution. Madison realized that the ratification in Virginia was in doubt and was in jeopardy, so he got himself elected to the convention in Virginia. Well, once again, the deliberate, soft-spoken Madison responded to the dynamic Patrick Henry with well-reasoned, rational arguments, and Virginia was the 10th state to ratify the Constitution. Once again, Patrick Henry took the defeat personally. Number five, election to Congress and advisor to Washington. After Virginia ratified the Constitution, Madison returned to New York to serve in the Continental Congress and as a special advisor to Washington. George Washington recommended that Madison run for the new U.S. Senate. Madison ran, but was blocked by Patrick Henry. So Madison decided to run for the new House of Representatives. Patrick Henry convinced the Virginia legislature to realign the boundaries, congressional boundaries, so that Madison could not run. Madison outmaneuvered that, and so Patrick Henry responded by getting the most popular candidate he could, James Monroe, to run against Madison for Congress, but Madison prevailed. Well, now a member of Congress, Madison became a principal advisor to the president in the executive branch of government. Washington recognized Madison's expertise in constitutional law, political philosophy, and political maneuvering. And for the same reason, Madison became the de facto leader of Congress. Interestingly, Madison drafted George Washington's first inaugural address. And ironically, Madison also wrote the official congressional response to Washington's address. So I could imagine mine. The congressional response, I think, said something like, well, Washington's address was the most brilliant speech ever written in history. So as Washington's advisor, Madison convinced or recommended to Washington that he select Jefferson as the first Secretary of State. And when Jefferson became president, he returned the favor by selecting Madison as his Secretary of State. Well, after the Revolutionary War, the northern states were in huge financial debt. This was a catastrophic situation. It affected everything. It affected banking, taxation, domestic commerce, international commerce. And without solving this debt, the nation could die an early death financially. So Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, introduced a bill in Congress to have the national government assume the debts of the state. This was called the Assumption Act. However, the southern states repeatedly blocked the Assumption Bill in Congress. Independently of that, Madison and the southern states proposed a bill to move the capital from New York or Philadelphia to the border of Maryland and Virginia along the Potomac River, more centrally located, and the northern states repeatedly blocked that bill in Congress. It's called the Residency Bill. Well, Thomas Jefferson in 1790 scheduled a private dinner between James Madison and Alexander Hamilton in Jefferson's New York residence, and alone together they worked out the famous dinner table bargain. They agreed to link Alexander Hamilton's Assumption Bill with Madison's Residency Bill. Hamilton agreed that he would use his influence in the northern states to move the capital to Washington, D.C., and Madison agreed that he would use his influence in the southern states to get the national government to assume the debts of the states. So this passed, was enacted, and became known as the famous the Great Compromise of 1790. The effect of that compromise is huge. It allowed Hamilton to create the first national bank. It allowed the Treasury Department to issue bonds. It stimulated the economy domestically and internationally, and it allowed America to borrow European money for the Louisiana Purchase and for the War of 1812. So number six, the father of the Bill of Rights. Madison initially opposed a Bill of Rights. He believed that a list of rights was unnecessary and would conflict with states' bills of rights. He also believed that it was impossible to agree upon and list our God-given rights. But Thomas Jefferson, who was in France during the Constitutional Convention, wrote Madison several letters saying that no Bill of Rights is a huge mistake. We've given power to the federal government, but where's the check against that power to protect the people? And so he strongly advocated in correspondence with Madison that there be a Bill of Rights. As Madison campaigned for Congress, he became convinced, and he made it a campaign promise that he would introduce a Bill of Rights into Congress. So he introduced the Bills of Rights into Congress, and he introduced over 200 proposed amendments. So Madison's work in drafting these, debating, passing, and ratifying the Bill of Rights gave him the title of the father of the Bill of Rights. Number seven, co-founder of the Democratic Party. So as the 1970s progressed, Washington's administration polarized into two major factions. One group was the New Federalist Party, headed by Alexander Hamilton. They represented the northern interest. They favored strong central government and close ties with Britain. The other group was led by Jefferson and Madison, which represented southern interest. They proposed close ties with France, strong states' rights, and westward expansion. Jefferson and Madison became so frustrated that they went on to organize their own party, the Democratic Republican Party, that was banded in 1820s and became the today's Democrat Party and the Whig Party. Number eight, got a campaign for Jefferson's presidency. In 1800, Jefferson ran against his former friend, John Adams, for the presidency. Jefferson wisely chose the brilliant James Madison as his campaign manager. It was a close race, and it ultimately ended up in the House of Representatives with repeated votes, but Madison used his influence in the House of Representatives, and Jefferson narrowly became president. Number nine, husband and family man. It's not surprising that in 1794, at the age of 43, the shy Madison was still single. So his friend Aaron Burr, who a decade later shot and killed Alexander Hamilton, introduced Madison to a 26-year-old young widow, Dolly Payne Todd. Her husband and one of her two sons had recently died on the same day from yellow fever. Well, Dolly Madison was beautiful, smart, vivacious, and very popular. She had an incredible memory for names and faces. She loved hosting and entertaining guests. She was the life of the party, the belle of the ball. She was the social opposite of James. And she had enough personality for both of them. So after a four-month courtship, they got married. Sadly, Dolly was excommunicated by the Quaker Church for marrying a non-member. Well, James had no children, but he adopted Dolly's surviving son, John Payne Todd. He was known as Payne, and he became a royal Payne. He was addicted to gambling and alcohol, and he brought James and Dolly a ton of grief. Well, Dolly used her personality and social gifts for good use when the couple lived in Washington. The White House was being constructed, and remember that President Jefferson was a widower. So Dolly became the de facto First Lady. She approved the furnishings for the White House. She also organized the banquets and all the social functions for President Jefferson. Well, and then when her husband became president, she became the official First Lady. She was so beloved and so popular that Congress, for the one and only time, gave her an honorary seat in Congress. Now, at one point, Madison had to come up with $40,000, the equivalent of $1 million today, to keep Payne out of debtor's prison. And Madison, around this time, had inherited Montpelier with its 108 slaves. Now, Madison's hypochondriac mother and fragile health lived in half of the house, and James and Dolly and Payne lived in the other half. His mother had her own servants, her own mealtime. They called her the old lady. And despite her sickly constitution, she died in 1829 at the age of 98. Number 10, Secretary of the State. Madison served as 8 years as Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State. Historians agree that his performance was brilliant. He was heavily involved in the Louisiana Purchase and the decision to send the Marines to Tripoli. Ironically, Madison and Jefferson were both strict constitutionalists and believed in the sacredness of the Constitution. They both knew that the president had no authority at all to expand the country by 50%. That would require a constitutional amendment or at least an act of Congress, but they both ignored the Constitution, went ahead with the Louisiana Purchase, and it worked. So Madison proved that sometimes you have to set aside your strong personal beliefs for the better good of political realities. Parenthetically, Abraham Lincoln, who considered the Constitution sacred, violated the Constitution when he issued his proclamation order unilaterally freeing the slaves without Congress, and when he suspended the congressional protection of habeas corpus. So it's interesting that under certain circumstances, even these great men set aside their personal beliefs for the greater good and the practical realities. Number 11, the election of 1808 and the presidency. In 1808, Jefferson, just like Washington before him, declined to run for a third term. A lot of people recommended he run for a third term. His second term was not the best. So he decided to retire, and he endorsed Madison as his replacement. Madison defeated the obscure Federalist candidate. Historians agree that if Federalist Alexander Hamilton was still alive at the time, he would have been our fourth president. The dynamic, popular, well-respected, and charismatic Hamilton would have won in a landslide against the shy little Madison. So it's interesting how one bullet from Aaron Burr changed history that much. Well, during the next 8 years, Dolley became the official first lady after serving as the unofficial first lady for 8 years. Okay, number 12, the War of 1812. No one seems to know much about the War of 1812, but the Brits and the French were fighting against each other with Napoleon. The Brits were having a shortage of sailors for their navy, and so they boarded and kidnapped American crews. So they weren't obviously recognizing us as a sovereign nation and recognizing our independence, and so this became an illegal and intolerable situation. The public demanded war with Britain once again so we could prove our independence and our right to be a nation. Madison initially opposed that because of the debts that it would raise and the taxes that would be required. But more and more people were elected to Congress who advocated a second war of independence. And so Madison finally succumbed. And on June 1st of 1812, he proposed a declaration of war. And the declaration was approved in Congress along party lines. Madison assumed that this would be a short war. We would capture Canada quickly and then use that as a bargaining chip against Britain. Unfortunately, the northern governors refused to allow their militias to fight Madison's war, and we were defeated against Canada. Now, on the Western Front, the British had convinced Chief Tecumseh to form a confederation of two dozen tribes to knock the U.S. out of the Great Lakes area and the Ohio Valley. The British provided rifles and powder. Madison strategically appointed William Henry Harrison to eliminate the Indian threat. Harrison was victorious in the Ohio Valley, became a national hero, and that led to his presidency. In the Western Front, once again, but South, Madison strategically appointed Andrew Jackson to defeat the Creek Indians and the British who were trying to drive the Americans out of the South. Jackson was victorious, became a national hero, and he too became president. Well, when the British defeated Napoleon, they turned their whole military force on America. They landed their army off of Chesapeake Bay in August of 1814 and marched on Washington. As the British Army marched on Washington, Madison grabbed his secretary's pistol and ran out to the front. He became the only sitting president to engage in combat with the troops. Being on the front lines, he quickly realized that his two pistols were not that effective against British trained rifles and cannons, and so he quickly started helping out with an artillery battery. But as the rockets and bullets started flying around, Madison either panicked and fled or was escorted, depending on different historical accounts, to the rear of the army where he led the retreat. And so he was in the front of the army on both sides. Now they left the US Marines at the front to stall the British army so that Madison and the American army could retreat successfully. The Marines stood their ground and were slaughtered. Well, in his retreat from Washington, Madison forgot one important detail, Dolly. She was sitting, waiting in the White House. So she was convinced that the Americans would have a quick victory over the British army, and so she prepared a huge celebration feast for her husband and for the American generals. Well, while waiting in the White House, she finally got a message from Madison that said, in essence, run for your life. Well, she kept her wits about her. She loaded two full wagons of important government documents, and then she personally saved the famous Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington. Well, when the British entered the White House, they found this huge feast ready for them. So after whining and dining and pigging out, they burned the White House to the ground. And then they burned the rest of the government buildings in Washington, D.C. to the ground, except for the Marine Corps headquarters. And as part of the Marine Corps legend, that the British saved the Marine Corps headquarters out of respect for that Marine line that was courageously slaughtered during the battle. So after burning the White House in Washington, Madison accurately predicted that the Brits would move on New Orleans to try to block commerce on the Mississippi. Madison got word to Andrew Jackson to move as fast as possible to New Orleans, and miraculously, Madison, with his troops, cannons, and supplies, traveled 45 miles through Louisiana swamps in one day. So that gave him time to prepare for the British Army and Navy. Andrew Jackson was outnumbered, but he prepared ahead of time, and he won in the famous Battle of New Orleans. Well, unbeknownst to everyone, a month earlier, the negotiators had ended the war. It was a tie, and there were no major concessions. But because of the timing, Americans believed that the Battle of New Orleans defeated the English and won the war. And so after that, there was a euphoria in the nation. We finally were worthy of respect. We finally won our second independence. And this was the era of good feelings, an unprecedented era of prosperity. Well, since Washington, D.C. had been burned to the ground, there was a huge groundswell to move the capital back to Philadelphia or New York, but Dolly Madison was the one who successfully opposed that move. Well, number 13, Madison's views on religion. He was a deist, like Jefferson, and Franklin was a non-churchgoer. Like Jefferson, he believed in a high wall of church and state, primarily to protect religion from the corruption of government. Now we look at that as the opposite paradigm, is there to protect government from religion, but their philosophy was the opposite. They opposed the appointments of chaplains in Congress and in the armed forces. Jefferson and Madison refused to issue proclamations of thanksgiving, and they refused the national census to include questions on religion. Madison's view on slavery. Madison thought that slavery was a necessary part of the Southern economy. At the Constitutional Convention, he proposed that there be an immediate end to the importation of slaves. There was a compromise, and Congress was barred from interfering with the international slave trade until 1808. Coincidentally, that became the year that Madison was elected president. Madison also proposed that slaves be counted in the apportionment for the House of Representatives in taxation purpose. There was a compromise. Slaves were counted, but a slave would be counted as three-fifths of a person. So that became the infamous three-fifths compromise, that slave indentured people would be counted, but only three-fifths of a person. Madison believed that the slaves would never assimilate into the Southern culture, and so he became interested in establishing African-American colonies in Africa. In the 1830s, Madison became the president of the American Colonization Society, which founded the country of Liberia as a country for slaves. He was naively surprised to discover that most American-born slaves had no desire to return to Africa. And so historically, in the long term, those descendants of slaves that remained in America fared better than those slaves that returned to Liberia. Number 15, his Indian policies. Madison and Jefferson had a paternalistic attitude toward the Indians. We just needed to get them to stop hunting and start farming. Easier said than done. Now, as the settlers started moving into Indian territory, Madison ordered the U.S. Army to protect the Native Americans and their land from the intrusion by settlers. This was opposed by his military commander, Andrew Jackson, who vehemently opposed this philosophy. Parenthetically, let me add that according to Andrew Jackson, his philosophy was the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And in the War of 1812, he ordered massacres of American Native villages. When Davy Crockett refused to murder innocent children, Andrew Jackson accused him of being a coward and threatened to have him shot. Also, during his presidency, Jackson forced the relocation of multiple Indian tribes hundreds of miles to the Oklahoma territories. This became the infamous Trail of Tears, where tens of thousands of Indians died of exposure, starvation, and disease. It's ironic that despite this ethnic cleansing, Jackson's image remains on our money, but Madison's does not. Well, number 16, and finally, the last years. Madison left office in 1817. He was 65 years of age and returned to Montpelier. Just like Washington and Jefferson, he left government a lot poorer than when he entered, unlike today's politicians. Madison helped Jefferson establish the University of Virginia, and in 1826, when Jefferson died, Madison became the second president of the University of Virginia. Madison became known as the Sage of Montpelier, and a steady stream of guests came to visit. The main reason they came to visit was not to see James, but to see Dolly. And so her hosting and entertaining skills became famous. She sat at the head of the table and managed the meal and the conversation. Little James sat in the middle on the side, inconspicuously. And when Dolly invited the guests to engage in card games or other games, Madison left and see if he could get one of the guests to sit down at a separate card table and play chess. One of the guests was the famous Marquis Lafayette. During a dinner, Marquis impolitely accused Madison of hypocrisy on the slave issue. Madison did not have a good response, and Madison wrote some very negative comments about Lafayette after that in correspondence to Jefferson. Well, near the end of his life, Madison devoted most of his last years to organizing those 12,000 pages of government documents, but it looks like he may have lost a few of his marbles. He became obsessed with his legacy and paranoid that people would not understand him, so he started falsifying documents. So in the letters where he made negative comments about Lafayette, the popular Lafayette, he removed those comments and actually forged Jefferson's writing. Well, as death approached, Madison's doctor offered him drugs to keep him alive until July 4th, the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, so that he could die on July 4th, just like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams 10 years earlier. Madison declined. Madison died in Montpelier on the morning of June 28th, 1836. this sickly Madison lived to be 85 years old. And he was buried in Montpelier. In his will, he made donations to the American Colonization Society, the University of Virginia, and Princeton University. He left Dolly $30,000, which should have been enough for her to live comfortably. Sadly, she turned the management of the plantation and her finances over to her son. And when she died, she was financially destitute. Montpelier, the beautiful home, the library, the furnishings, and all of the slaves were put up for auction to satisfy Payne's gambling debts. So in 1984, the National Trust for Historic Preservation became the ninth owner of the plantation. Archaeological historians from nearby Colonial Williamsburg began a lengthy restoration, and in the year 2000, the Montpelier Foundation took over the property, and Montpelier has been returned to its former glory, and you'll see a picture, small picture of Montpelier in the handout. Well, in closing, James Madison was the last of the original founding fathers to pass away. With his death came the end of an era that Thomas Jefferson called the Assembly of Demagogues. And such is the life and legacy of James Madison, the father of the Constitution and father of the Bill of Rights. Thank you. I'll leave it up to the leaders on whether we have time for questions or not.
All right, Judge London, thank you very much for being here, for enlightening us with more insights about President Madison. Do we have any questions? Anybody want to? Yes.
Why is there a Broadway musical about
that? How many of you have seen the musical Hamilton? I haven't. I hear they have a scene where he wanted to, a song about the dinner between the two where they worked out that 1790 compromise. It's because he's the Rodney Dangerfield. Gets no respect. And then in Washington, D.C., there's not, except for the Library of Congress, as far as I know, there's not a single statue anywhere to Madison. Just incredible. Yes?
So Thomas Jefferson and James Madison attended church often, or never?
Rarely, if ever. So, and like Ben Franklin, they were deists. They felt that God was the creator, but he wasn't that actively involved in human affairs. And they occasionally attended church, but Madison and Franklin had little interest in religion. They were devoted to other things. Jefferson had his own Bible called the Jefferson Bible, that went through the New Testament and cut out every passage he disagreed with. He also cut out every passage where Jesus declared himself as the Son of God and the miracles. And so it's called the Jefferson's Bible. It's in Congress. So he knew more about religion than Madison and Franklin, but they were pretty much non-religious, but they were huge advocates of freedom of religion, interestingly. Other questions?
You said that the White House was burned down. Was it rebuilt the same location, or was it?
Okay, the myth and legend is that the bricks were so badly damaged that they couldn't repair the bricks, so they plastered it over and whitewashed it, and that's how we got the White House. That's not true. So that's what everyone's taught in school. The foundations were still there, part of it was still there, and so they just rebuilt it. But it wasn't by accident that it became the White House. Good question. Other questions?
Did you run into anything that would suggest why separation of church and state didn't get into the Constitution?
You mean that word?
That whole concept.
Well, it is. Well, in the First Amendment, with the Establishment and Free Exercise Clause, that's where it comes from. And the phrase, a wall of separation of church and state, comes from a letter Madison wrote to Jews in Rhode Island who were worried about a state-established religion. And he said we needed freedom of religion and a high wall of separation of church and state. So that's the first use of that phrase. The concept came from Roger Williams before Jefferson, and Jefferson was well-read, so he knew this. And Roger Williams there said there should be a high hedge of separation from church and state to protect religion from government. And so, but that phrase, so the U.S. Supreme Court and a lot of the decisions use the phrase separation of church and state as kind of a nickname, but that's not in the Constitution, but the free exercise of religion is. And they debated that language for 3 months.
Well, but if I remember correctly, 7 of the 13 states had established churches at the time the Constitution was signed. Does that
yes.
sound right?
Yes. Most of the
and
colonies had established states.
With them in the next 25 years. So the idea was there. I'm just puzzled
well,
as to why it never got into print.
Yeah, there's debates on what the First Amendment means back and forth. The one thing that everyone is certain on interpreting the First Amendment is that there would be no national church. That's the only thing that all the scholars agree on. And so that established there would be no national church, but several of the states had established religions in their states until later. Yes?
Did Madison have any character flaws or other personal challenges that he had to overcome to accomplish what he did?
What, this wasn't enough? Well, I'm going to tell a joke I'll probably get in trouble with. Who was the active African-American actor with the one eye who was friends with Frank Sinatra?
Sammy Davis
Jr. He said someone asked him on the golf course and said, what's your handicap? He said, I'm a short, black, one-eyed little Jew, and you ask me what my handicap is? So being sickly, I think, you know, if I had to guess, I think he probably had some gastrointestinal syndrome that wasn't that bad, but, you know, a weak stomach kind of thing. And with his mom's hypochondria, that was kind of exaggerated. But his growth was stunted. So if he had something like celiacs, growing up with that can stunt your growth. But I don't know of any other character flaws. As far as we know, he was honest, straightforward, extremely well-respected. And so that's why he ended up at the top of all these things, because he was just solid. Good question.
Seems like Jefferson, Madison, these guys studied a lot of Greek and Roman history and politics. How much influence did that have on their political philosophy and developing the Constitution?
A lot. They also studied John Locke and some of the European, Montesquieu. They were extremely well read. When the Library of Congress was burned, Jefferson allowed his 9,000 volume library to be used to restart Library of Congress, and they have a Jefferson collection there. But they read everything. They just absorbed it and they read it. Although both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson are recognized as what are called universal geniuses. That's a special category. There have only been about 30 universal geniuses in world history. That's a genius that's a genius in multiple categories. So unlike Einstein, he's in one category, but it's like Leonardo da Vinci. And so to have two universal geniuses, only two have been American, Jefferson and Franklin, at the same time in the same place, is a miracle. But Madison was competing with them, he just worked harder. Okay, well thank you very much. Thank you.
One final question, Judge Lennon, other than the people you've already spoken on, Franklin, Madison, who's next?
Well, the last four or five times I spoke on my heroes. This time I picked Madison because I didn't know anything about him, just like everybody else. And so I studied him for a year. Luckily, my daughter recently moved to Fairfax, Virginia. So a few months ago, we visited her and went through Montpelier, listening to the docents. And I heard two docents at lunch, I should have stayed there, arguing on whether Madison was a coward in War of 1812, or whether he was escorted to protect the president. And so it was kind of interesting. So I lucked out to be able to visit Montpelier a couple months ago, and that's a great way to learn. Go to the Reagan Library, go to Mount Vernon, and go to Montpelier. So that's a great way to learn about him. So I'm not sure, I'll have to think about who next year will be.
A couple of quick points before we let you